Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Arthur Brooks. He's the president of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., a leading think tank that is nonpartisan, but is also generally known to lean to the right. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Arthur, welcome to the program.
Hi, Grant. Great to be with you.
Well, you're here in Syracuse to talk about political conservatism in America, so let me start with a few questions about that. It seems that the most vibrant public energy and conservatism in recent years has come from citizens working under the banner of the Tea Party. First, let me just ask you, is that impression indeed correct?
Yeah, that's right. And part of that is because, or perhaps all of that, is because it's a grassroots movement. It's a grassroots ethical populist movement. And populist movements are always full of vitality. They're always full of energy that comes from, that can only come from communities not centrally planned from governments. So it's not surprising at all. You'd see a lot of vitality in this, and this is where it would be coming from on the right today.
Do you think that's going to be the case in the next few years going forward, too, that this group will be what pushes the energy forward?
It could. It depends a lot on what happens in this current election cycle, of course. One of the things that the political right in America has to come to terms with is the fact that every time somebody that they're basically sympathetic to gets in power, they tend to demobilize. And political demobilization is death. And it's especially true because one of the characteristics of Republicanism in the United States is that when Republicans get into power at the national level, they tend to go native and become every bit as statist as Democrats do. So the result of that is that you see every year an increase in the percentage of GDP that gets eaten up by government, the percentage of people that pay zero taxes, all the things that conservatives, particularly free enterprise conservatives, don't like, continue apace, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. And the biggest reason that that happens when Republicans are elected is because conservative activists go home. And that's going to have to be something that Tea Partiers are going to have to guard against if, in point of fact, the Republicans are successful in 2012.
And you mentioned a couple things earlier about why you think that this group has been so effective, the populist nature of it, the grassroots nature of it. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about if there are other characteristics about the movement you think that have contributed to its success.
For sure. The Tea Party, love it or hate it, is a moral movement. It's not a materialistic movement. They talk an awful lot about economic policy, but they talk about economic policy from a profoundly ethical standpoint. And the way to understand this is to remember that when the Tea Party was really starting to mobilize in the first place, it was the exact same time that street riots were starting to pop up all over southern Europe, most notably in Greece. And there was a huge contrast between the Tea Partiers and the Greek rioters. And it's kind of worth paying attention to because it tells you what you need to know about the energy of the Tea Parties. In Greece, people were throwing Molotov cocktails, burning down public buildings, demanding relatively lavish pensions, demanding that their salaries be paid by their fellow employees or fellow citizens, and demanding that the government continue to perpetuate a large welfare state. At the same time, the Tea Partiers were demanding that the government not do what the Greeks were demanding. In other words, they were saying, take away these benefits, get smaller, give us less stuff, effectively. That's an extraordinary thing. That the only thing that can motivate that is a sense of right and wrong as opposed to a sense of materialistic justice. And that has to be propelling a whole lot of energy, and in fact, it was.
One of the things that's curious to me about it, thinking about our political history, is it seems like a concern about the debt and the deficit is always everyone's second or third issue. So we've seen candidates try to run on this before and not get very far. And then all of a sudden it becomes the most important, or at least apparently the most important thing for this group of people. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, this is a really incredible phenomenon that if you look at the top nine issues that people care about, which is something that we, in the public opinion world, we pay a lot of attention to. What are the nine things that would most affect your vote for president? Eight are the economy. And those things are all about the ethical case for not stealing from our children, from not putting up undue barriers to the creation of businesses, to not get in the way of entrepreneurs. And that's why this is an ethical movement. This is a populist movement based on the idea of right and wrong as manifest in our economic policies. Now, this happens occasionally. I mean, we obviously saw this during the Reagan Revolution. And we're seeing it repeat itself. One of the things that's interesting and I think actually encouraging about the United States is that in times of national turmoil, like we're seeing in this recession, people have a tendency to turn ethically to the principles of the founders. the founders talked about a great deal about, obviously, about liberty, about opportunity, about being the freest country in the history of the world. How is that made manifest? How do you flex your muscles of liberty? And the answer for most Americans is, in fact, the free enterprise system. When we deal with conservatism in our culture, we deal with it very, very deeply. It's very infrequent that it's about social issues. It's more likely to pop up culturally and be made manifest in economic issues, and that's what we're seeing today. This is not an economic struggle. This is a culture war.
And one of the things that the Tea Party movement has been criticized for, I guess, is where it has gotten some of its funding. And there's been some controversy about, you know, you mentioned it being a grassroots movement. One of the criticisms is it may not be that much of a grassroots movement. What do you make of that?
I don't make much of that. You know, I've talked to a lot of folks that are involved in Tea Party activity. You're talking about the Koch brothers, for example.
For example.
This is what's gotten a whole lot of publicity. When I talk to people that are involved in Tea Party activity, most of them don't even know who the Koch brothers are. You know, they find their local friends. They know they're going to a rally. They hire a bus on their own money. It's way more grassroots than when you get union activity, for example, which truly has to be centrally funded because it's centrally planned. So I don't make very much of that at all. I mean, there are, of course, people that are paying for these types of activities. But given the scale of what's going on in this country, there's just really not enough money out there to make a meaningful dent in it.
And I want to broaden it now, thinking about conservatism and the conservative movement more generally, in terms of policy positions. What do you think will be the two or three most important planks for the conservative movement in the next few years?
The conservative movement today, of course, the most important plank is going to be deficits, debt, growth, jobs, and similar issues leading in every case to what we're going to do about entitlements. So number one is economic policy regarding how much money we're paying out relative to how much money we're taking in. And it's going to be the ethical case about whether or not it's right to do things that affects future generations adversely. So that's going to be number one. Number two is going to be, and we're not thinking about it now, but in 5 years we're going to regret the fact that we didn't think about it more now, is something about national security. National security is never in the big nine issues until something blows up around the world and suddenly it's on everybody's lips. Policy organizations, scholars like you and me, people that really care about public policy and politics need to be taking national security issues more seriously than we currently are. Because if we don't do deep thinking about America's role in the world right now, we're not going to be prepared for really what's happening. A lot of Americans don't understand right now that we're effectively demilitarizing. We're spending a lot of money on the military, but we don't have a modernized military. We're falling behind in our ability to do the things that we've taken for granted in the past. Now, maybe that's okay, but it's important to do those things on purpose, and that's going to be a really big issue coming up in the next 5 years, but you have to see around the corner to understand it. And the third is going to be a whole series of social issues, that some of which we don't know about yet, but some of them are going to be in greater consensus on things like gay marriage, probably, I think, a changing set of opinions about abortion in this country in ways that liberals don't like and conservatives do. So some are going to break the conservative way, some are going to break the liberal way.
Yeah, I want to come back to those social issues in a minute. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Arthur Brooks, the president of the American Enterprise Institute. Well, the United States is often described as a center-right country, and in that sense, it is said to naturally lean conservative. And poll questions about how people think of themselves in these terms seem to corroborate that. So I wanted to ask you, is there some kind of meaningful qualitative difference between a real conservative and someone in the mainstream? And if so, what is it? Or are we really talking more a matter of relative degree here?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of people who would like to have some sort of acid test to figure out if you're a real conservative. You know, I think that, you know, I've seen all the polls that suggest that we are, in fact, a center-right nation. We're a center-right nation ethically. We do, about 70% of Americans say the free enterprise system is the best way to organize our economy despite the recession. About 70% of Americans say the government is too big and trying to do too much, and so they have this notion of constitutionally limited government, and they admire that a lot. But I wouldn't put too much credibility in those polls that say we're a center-right nation. The reason is because functionally, we're actually a European-style social democracy. People listening to us right now who agree with me politically, that are free enterprise advocates, that are relatively conservative politically, don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear it either. But in point of fact, 77% of Americans say we shouldn't change the entitlement system meaningfully. 64% of Americans say that everybody should get free health care. I mean, you just can't square these things with this notion that we're a center-right nation.
But when you look at those countries and you look at the European countries and you look at us, we're all on this continuum if we want to look at the size of government, the amount of spending and all that. But it is the case, though, that the United States sort of sits out away from the pack in those terms, right?
Well, sort of, yes and no. I mean, we have a more progressive tax code, as generally judged, than the European countries. We spend as much of GDP on government as Spain does, a country that's been ruled for the big majority of years since the overturn of their dictatorship by the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party. We have 70% of Americans who take more out of the tax system than they put into it. We have 51% of Americans who paid no federal income tax. This looks an awful lot like a social democracy to me. And you can say we stand out because we spend a little bit less on social welfare goods, but actually that's not true when you throw the nonprofit sector in there. The American nonprofit sector is bigger and more active than it is in virtually all of our allied nations. You throw that into what the government's doing, and it turns out that we spread around a lot of welfare too.
Well, I wanted to come back to those social issues that you brought up before, and you know, I imagine we could spend hours just on this one question, but in terms of social issues versus economic issues, there is sometimes a split regarding conservatism. You alluded to it. Young people, for example, are often attracted to economic conservatism, but they're put off by social conservatism. So how do those two realms of conservatism fit together in your view?
Well, it is true that when you go to a university campus, we have AEI, American Enterprise Institute, the institution that I run, has a huge presence now on campuses all over the United States. And you find that when people are starting to experiment with conservative ideas, the gateway ideology, if you will, is kind of libertarianism. It's to say, you know, just get the government out of the economy, but leave it out of social issues, and let's not spend money on the military because all that yucky, you know, bombing and killing. And so that's the way people tend to start, as it turns out. Most people have a tendency, and I'm speaking looking at how people develop ideologically as opposed to any opinion that I have about what I think is right. And, you know, I've looked at these data for years and years because in teaching at the university, that you find that people, as they get older, get more socially conservative, and they get more conservative with respect to the role of the American military. They think about security in different ways, and they're more confident about the role of American leadership around the world. In other words, things get less simple, and we need a more complicated ideology, and that's how that comes in. So it's not too surprising that you have this kind of schism as America is trying to turn back to what conservatism means, and that would start with the youth movement.
I wanted to ask a question about religion and politics, because that has come under renewed scrutiny in recent months. I wanted to ask you, how do you think religion and politics are fitting together at the moment? Do you have any concerns about the relationship?
Not especially. I think that I would be a lot more alarmed if this were 1992, where there was the tension in religion and politics was much, much higher in those days. I think people are a great deal more comfortable than they are. I mean, obviously these issues are going to come up from time to time. You're going to see, I mean, right now we have a major presidential candidate who is a religious conservative, an avowed open religious conservative. Conservatives themselves, or the conservative movement, is not deeply troubled by this, and it doesn't. You know, conservatives don't even talk about this very much, including secular conservatives. Where it's really coming up is I hear this in left-wing communities, where people are saying, "See, the religious right wants to take over again." I don't buy it. I actually don't see that. I think that the economic right is really ascendant right now, and it's eclipsing the religious right, which has fallen into kind of an equilibrium.
So you don't see the religion coming in and making it tougher to have some kinds of political debates that citizens need to have absent that?
Not especially. I mean, I think there's some that are really hot right now. I mean, the HHS mandate debate, for example. But as far as I'm concerned, and this is just, of course, how I see it, and a lot of people are going to disagree with me, this is not the religious right asserting itself. This is the secular left asserting itself on something that was the status quo of ordinary Americans who were relatively religious. This is a landmine that I think the secular left kind of stepped on, because we have a lot of people in government today who have no real flavor, don't have any intuition about how, for example, ordinary Catholics, how they see life, how they see the role of government. This is a big opportunity, of course, for the political right that they're not taking. The political right shouldn't be talking about the HHS mandate and say this is about funding contraception and this is about people's sex lives. That's a big mistake. What they should be talking about, in my view, what the presidential candidate should be talking about, is that this is a question of religious freedom, and they're going to stand up for religious freedom. They're going to fight for religious freedom.
Well, let me continue on this theme of possible tensions. I wanted to get your take on the Republican nominating process. And there are two schools of thought out there on this, the more popular one being that in terms of the general election, the tenor of the nomination campaign is not helping the cause. It's generating a lot of negative messages about Mitt Romney, assuming that he's the presumptive nominee, and it's making it hard for him to focus on the president. Now, the other school of thought is that it's generating lots of attention, it's heightening the general energy, and it's providing a proving ground for the eventual nominee. What's your read on this process?
My view is the second. My view is that, we talk every season when there's a bitter primary, people say, oh, it's never been this bad, it's worse than you think. It's incredibly polarizing. It's going to kill the party, whoever party's having it. It's destroying comedy in C-O-M-I-T-Y in Washington, D.C. That's all nonsense. Look, I mean, this is not the kind of country where, you know, if your party or your guy doesn't get elected, you're going to get a knock in the night from a jackbooted thug. Come on. You know, it's like I didn't support President Obama in 2008, and I run a major American institution that's involved in politics or involved in policy. Nothing happened to me. No big deal. Look, this is the United States. This is still a democracy. We still understand that this is legitimate when the other party wins or the other guy wins. This is all great that we're trying to hash out some of these major issues. I think that Mitt Romney is getting better by the week as a result of the fact that he has to stand up to a lot of issues, and he's not going to face them for the first time in the general campaign. I mean, we should be celebrating this stuff. This is part of democracy. This is great.
And I guess looking back on one cycle, you know, it didn't seem to hurt Barack Obama to have the protracted fight with Hillary Clinton for the nomination either.
No, by the time he got into the general campaign, he'd heard every question already. He was ready for it. This is a guy who hadn't done that much in public life. He hadn't gone through that many campaigns, and he got an absolute proving ground because of his primary. It's good for him.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute. Well, I wanted you to give me the conservative perspective on economic inequality. You've talked about economics a bit. Our levels of economic inequality have been higher than normal, historically speaking, for a couple of decades, but they've been getting a lot more press and public attention of late. What does a conservative say about that issue?
Depends on who the conservative is. There are plenty of conservatives that are concerned, per se, about economic inequality. In my view, the key issues are whether or not consumption is changing in its equality, not income per se. Look, I mean, we've got a tax code where if you look at just the pay that comes in your check, it tells you really nothing. I mean, you have to – how much are you getting in government services? How much are you paying in taxes, et cetera, et cetera. So what really matters is how much people are consuming, and that hasn't changed very much over the years. That hasn't changed very much at all, and it leads to a lot less alarm than what a lot of people are talking about. Number two, what we should be paying attention to is the fact that the reason, if there is a lot more inequality, as economists are looking at it in income, it's because the top 1% has done so much better. It's not that the bottom 99% has fallen. It's not even that the bottom 99% has gotten a lot more unequal. The problem isn't the top 10% or top 5%. It's that the people in the 1% have gotten richer over the past decade, and so Americans have to decide whether or not the entrepreneurial class doing really well, whether or not it bothers them, whether or not they want to tear those guys down, just for the sake of getting more equality. And the last thing to keep in mind is what we should not be paying attention to is income inequality. It's mobility. You know, the big difference between the United States and most of the European countries that still exists is that the United States considers itself to be an opportunity society. I saw an old poll, maybe it was from the Rural Value Survey or something, asking about the people's opinions about big public figures. It was about 5 years ago, and one of the guys in the poll they were asking about was Bill Gates, back when he was still the richest man in the world. And, you know, they asked Americans and they asked Frenchmen about Bill Gates. And Americans said, basically, I hope my kid is the next Bill Gates. And the French answer was basically, let's, burn down his house and take his stuff. That's the difference between an envy-based society and aspiration-based society. We can't lose that, and the way we don't lose that is with mobility. Now, the truth is that American mobility has decreased, and that's what conservatives need to be paying attention to. Throw out all this nonsense about getting a more equal income distribution. That's boring. Americans don't care about it very much, and we shouldn't care about it. What we should care about is whether people can rise, and if they can't, we should be really alarmed. The reason that there is less mobility in America today is, number one, we're not thinking very seriously about culture for people who are traditionally poor. one of my colleagues at AEI, Charles Murray, has a new best-selling book out called Coming Apart that talks about the cultural influences that are keeping people down, that are making it hard for them to have a culture of work, for example, a culture of excellence, a culture of entrepreneurship. The second thing is that we have a big civil rights crisis in our schools. We have entire school systems that are built for grown-ups. They're not built for kids. And that doesn't, you know, you're my kids, you're going to be okay. But a lot of kids that are coming from backgrounds, for example, like mine when I was a kid, where we didn't have any money, you know, that's the kind of thing that would have really, really held me back. And we're hurting these people. And finally, we need to think more seriously about what a culture of entrepreneurship means for our communities. You know, one of the most exciting things about Syracuse University over the past 10 years, the past 7 years, I guess, is that it's trying to be all about how to make a more entrepreneurial community in a place that has had a lot of trouble, Syracuse, New York, how to make this place more vital, how to have people from all socioeconomic groups, people from all races, people from all backgrounds have more opportunity. How can a university do that? We need more ideas like the concept of Syracuse University Scholarship in Action. That's what we need more of. And then we can start dealing with the mobility issue.
And before we get to the three questions at the end, I wanted you to tell me, and I think you've already been doing this along the way, but tell me a little bit about your new book, The Road to Freedom.
Road to Freedom's new book is coming out May 8th. It is coming out from Basic Books. The subtitle is How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. It's a call to action on the policies that we actually need. And the fundamental thesis is that the conservative movement, the free enterprise movement, actually has not been successful, as not as successful as it thinks, or at least as the left thinks, because it's failed to make moral arguments for free enterprise. And the book is all about the moral case for free enterprise and how to make those moral arguments in a way that people who are persuadable, people who are on the fence, people who can really benefit from the culture of free enterprise, they can understand what the blessings of the system really are.
Well, let me get to the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Just making it from day to day.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is actually I think I have trouble getting the machine off. I'm running an institution in Washington, D.C., which is a city that's always really on. And it's a little hard for me to get it turned off and pay the right kind of attention to the rest of my life.
And last, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think it's actually moving from being a professor at the Maxwell School at SU to running an organization. That's an achievement, or it's at least a phase of my life where I've learned a lot about my life. And what I've figured out is no matter how hard or difficult or foolish or scary something is, if I think it needs to get done, I do it. And I'm not sure whether or not I like that, but I certainly have learned that about myself.
That was Arthur Brooks. His new book is The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Arthur, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Grant. It's great to be with you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.